Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 80, section 3, which is old single column, page 891. Okay, so we have a little bit more on setting the stage for the Andite migrations in Europe. You know, we have a little bit more to go through yet. We haven't totally gotten all this laid out. There's, as we saw last time as we were getting into it, there's a lot of complexity to the pre-Andite nature of Europe, the peoples of Europe. They not only took us back and kind of reminded us of the whole Neanderthal phenomenon and the back mating and all the to do. We also got that immediately preceding section about the climatic and geologic changes that were so important to this setting the stage. But the main thing we want to remind ourselves of, that unlike other areas, far removed from Mesopotamia, Europe had a very definitive, pure, basically pure, relatively pure, Adamite infusion. Those people, before there was a lot of blending of the Adamites with other peoples, even to the point of, getting down to Andite level, you had Adamites going into Europe, and not vast numbers where, they basically sort of took over, if you will, the genetics of the domain. You have this blue man predominant stock and with a lot of Andonite, in particular, way back Andonite as Neanderthal, blended in. And that slightly amped up evolutionary stock gives peoples, relatively, what scientists think of as modern sort of peoples in Europe, like the peoples that we call Cro-Magnon or Cro-Magnon, depending on whether you want to be kind of Frenchish about it or more English. And see, it's those peoples that they want to speak about a little bit. You got to let their story play out for quite a while. They get kind of isolated. Remember, we touched on that. I mean, let their story play out a little while before we bring the Andites in en masse, especially the Andites on horseback. Okay, towards the tail end of the Andite migrations. So that's what we're going to do here. We're going to look a little bit at this, and this is where they touch upon a number of things that most people are familiar with about those early humans. Post-Neanderthal is kind of the way scientists talk about post-Neanderthal humans in Europe. Things like fancy cave paintings and what have you. So let's jump in here, see what we've got.
Number 3, the Cro-Magnoid Blue Man. The ancient centers of the culture of the Blue Man were located along all the rivers of Europe, but only the Somme now flows in the same channel which it followed during pre-glacial times.
Okay, so a couple little things there. You know, it's just a tiny little paragraph. So they're, you know, they're wanting you to pause and just kind of get your bearings a little bit. I mean, first of all, notice they threw in this this coinage of Cro-Magnoid or Cro-Magnoid, depending on how you want to say it. You know, what's the OID about? Remember how they mentioned, I mean, what we call the Cro-Magnons is are just one of many different genetic flavors, similar genetic flavors there, like that. And so, you know, Cro-Magnoid, you know, Cro-Magnon-like peoples. Okay, so just a way of speaking of it directly, you know, reminding you of the complexity and that sort of as a generalization. Other times, you know, as we'll see, they'll just use Cro-Magnon as a general term, kind of like humans used to as well. But they are, you know, occasionally throwing in that little detail to remind you that it's not all one flavor there that you might specifically call Cro-Magnon. Okay, then the other thing they do is remind us of a point they made very early on, very, very early on when they were talking about the Andonites moving into Europe, you know, going back immediately in the wake of Andon and Fonta, you know, in those first years those first millennia, I suppose I should say, of the Andonites being in existence as wool creatures on the earth and spreading all over the place. The River Somme in France, if you're not familiar, I mean, the Somme is basically straight north of Paris, and you have the Seine River flowing through Paris. How it kind of flows, if you're familiar, it flows sort of northwest, right, through Paris, heading towards the English Channel. The Somme is basically precisely parallel with the Seine, north of Paris, again, flowing into the English Channel. Only unlike the Seine, or any other rivers around there, like they're pointing out, the Somme avoided being ground, you know, away by the glaciers. So you've got this very, very old, going all the way back to the beginning of wool creatures, valley there, that has always been a big attraction. And, you know, when they just, see, without giving you the specifics, what they're giving you between the lines there is, you know, when they say that it's the same channel which it followed during pre-glacial times. In other words, if you go there and dig, you know, you can find all kinds of human artifacts going way, way, way back. And that was one of the very first places back in the 19th century that they started digging up stuff and going, whoa, I think man has been around a lot longer than 4004 BC. I mean, I think he was maybe even hunting animals that are now extinct. You know, and he used these fancy, you know, stone tools to do it. All right. So it's the Somme River Valley is a very important archaeological location. So that's why they're bringing it up and reminding you of how, you know, kind of why it is, because it didn't get snowplowed by the glaciers like everything else did. Okay, so...
It's not covered by glaciers, though?
But remember, there was a little region right in that neck of the woods, you know, the very, you know, southern part of England and stuff, you know, especially remember a few further oceans rose and it was connected to the mainland. That little area right in there, the English Channel and kind of a little bit on either side, that didn't get glaciated. And like the Andonites would be, you know, standing on one leg, you know, trying to keep from being shoved into the sea by the glacier. You know, there was this little location that just, you know, didn't get snowplowed all the time, you know, as the glaciers went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so it's just, you know, it's just coincidence of the way things worked, that it got left unscathed. Whereas every other place is just completely, any human stuff that was there is gone because it was all washed away. And again, you can find very ancient human artifact stuff right there in that very southern part of England too, for the same reason. Okay, it was in those areas that they first, got suspicious about, I think mankind is, goes back a ways. Okay, stuff they were finding in that area.
Blasphemy.
Yes, right. Obviously, it's blasphemy to begin with, as we all know. Right at that exact same time, of course, you've got, Darwin publishing, Origin of Species, it's just everything was in turmoil right at that point there in the middle of the 19th century. Okay. We'll see some more about the importance of the Sum Valley in the story of Blue Man. Let me read forward a little ways. In fact, I can just remind people, if you want to go back and look, see, that's in paper. You don't have to do it right now, but if you want to go back at some point, paper 63, section 5 is where they first brought up the sum in the dispersion of the Andonites. Okay, if you want to go back and see what they said there. There they actually mention the tools and stuff that you can find there. All right, so that's the point of that little paragraph. It's like, okay, so yeah, we're there in Europe, and in that little area that was avoided, the glaciers avoided it. It couldn't help but kind of be a central location over all those hundreds of thousands of years that humans were there, because the glaciers were messing everything else up. All right, what else do they say?
While we speak of the Blue Man as pervading the European continent, there were scores of racial types. Even 35,000 years ago, the European Blue races were already a highly blended people, carrying strains of both red and yellow, while on the Atlantic coastlands and in the regions of present-day Russia, they had absorbed a considerable amount of Andonite blood, and to the south were in contact with the Saharan peoples. But it would be fruitless to attempt to enumerate the many racial groups.
Okay, just how many Cro-Magnoid, right? How many of those groups are alike, the Cro-Magnons proper? When they say even 35,000 years ago, that should remind you of been a long time since then. And so there's been lots and lots and lots and lots of blending in Europe subsequent to that. So you have to keep that in mind when you try to, can I find, some remnant of Blue Man there? You're not going to find anything that's sort of pure Blue Man, or even kind of pure Andonite, say, or anything like that. There's just been lots and lots of blending, but you did have, these tendencies that set up at least some lasting cultural or language impressions, even if genetically there's been an awful lot of mixing. Notice they're reminding you there. Remember how it always was with the Andonites. Once the Sangiks started moving around, originally you had the Andonites everywhere, but once the Sangiks started moving out of Central Asia, they were always shoving the Andonites to the margins. So we've mentioned many times, they get shoved north, all the way up into northern Europe and Asia, Siberia and what have you. Or they get shoved all the way to the Atlantic coast, little nooks and crannies that you know, and everything else is taken up by the other peoples, and they're kind of just living on this little peninsula sticking out in the Atlantic Ocean. You know, it's like, okay, we'll give you that little triangle of land, you know, or whatever. You know, so they're just shoved to the margins everywhere. But as long as they're still there, right, you know, over time, at the interface, you get mating and blending. We've already talked about how you end up with the Finno-Ugric languages up there in, you know, the northern part of Europe, heading over into Asia, different from Indo-European. In other words, different from Andite tongue-based languages because the Andonites up there, just like they're reminding you of here, that gives that different language group up there. It's all predicated on Andonite. Not to mention influences it might have gotten from Blue Man tongue, right? Okay, does everyone remember when they say even 35,000 years ago? What's the deal with 35,000 again? That's basically when the Ice Age came to an end, except at the poles like it still is today. Right? Yeah. So that's where they're starting the story. We're dropping back again and thinking about, the Ice Age is basically over, so everyone can go where they want to go now. And, and they're just going to remind us again of the Adamites coming in there now that it's the Ice Age is over, and what that, how that plays out. Only now it's a little bit more emphasis on the cultural issues of them coming in there than just the basic genetic fact of them coming in there. Okay, so what do they say?
The European civilization of this early post-Adamic period was a unique blend of the vigor and art of the Blue Men with the creative imagination of the Adamites. The Blue Men were a race of great vigor, but they greatly deteriorated the cultural and spiritual status of the Adamites. It was very difficult for the latter, to impress their religion upon the Cro-Magnoids because of the tendency of so many to cheat and to debauch the maidens. For 10,000 years, religion in Europe was at a low ebb as compared with the developments in India and Egypt.
Okay, so a number of things there. First of all, think about, since Blue Man favors the fourth adjutant, and we talked about this some last week, here it is again, how can you immediately understand why they would be mentioning things like vigor and art relative to Blue Man? Okay, he has he's favoring that individuality like adjutant of 4, 5, and 6. So he's innately going to be a little bit more directly in tune with the physicality of his body, right? Favoring the individuality like adjutant rather than the unity like one, the sixth, on the other end of the spectrum, right? So that just, that's why the vigor part, right? You sort of have this more definitive energizing of the body by the mind, in that sort of more to bringing it to the mind to a point like engagement with the fourth adjutant. Not to mention, right, and that's gets you to, I can bring my fingers together in a point, as opposed to if I favor a unity thing, I don't want to bring my fingers together into a, like that. I'm all fuzzed out. I could bring them together, and I could hold tool making devices, and I can hold tools. I can focus in on the detail of art. And so, see, it's just that individuality, consciousness, favoritism that gets him focused in, and not so, fuzzed out, and there's sort of just spirit, you know, equally, you know, diffused everywhere, like Red Man has a tendency to think. And he's going to focus in on animals and a spirit within the animal, and, you know, and but not outside, not everywhere. See, that's sort of just that favoritism of the fourth adjutant is what's behind that. But he's bringing in, you know, what you're bringing in to that, this upstepping from the Adamites. Just, you know, a more spiritualized nature. So that there's imagination. Like Sangiks don't have in and of themselves. Whenever an Adamic blood engages any Sangik, they're going to become more imaginative. Not so matter-of-fact, you know, mundane about things. And, you know, because it's not Andites, it's Adamites. They're leaving Mesopotamia. They have a significant culture, but they're not going by horseback, so, you know, they're drifting that direction. And by the time they get there, it's gotten a little muddled, especially to the point where, you are beginning to use the imagination to go off in on tangents in defiance of the mores. Okay, they're not respecting the mores, these people, because it's just too boring. Right, for their imaginative minds, so you get these things like, you discover the art of cheating and debauching the maidens. Right, so I mean the Adamites are just not going to be very accepted by Blue Man, as we'll see here in the next paragraph, who's very straight-laced. The fact that the Adamites are just so anything goes like this. So the potential religious quickening from the Adamites doesn't happen because the Blue Man can't get past these this total disrespect to the mores. All right. Okay, let's get that next tiny little additional paragraph.
The Blue Men were perfectly honest in all their dealings and were wholly free from the sexual vices of the mixed Adamites. They respected maidenhood, only practicing polygamy when war produced a shortage of males.
Like I said, they're very what we would call straight-laced. And just look at how strong the modifiers are, the adverbs. Perfectly honest. Oh my, that's a pretty strong thing to say. So, I suspect again, they delighted in how in the precision of honesty. Again, that fourth adjutant. Yeah, they can be just so precise. See. So they can be quote unquote perfectly honest. It just favors their mind tendency, that individuality consciousness.
They have to be politically correct.
the sexual vices. Now remember what a vice is historically. Try to take yourself out of what you might think of it today, especially with lots of, Christian energization of the word. Technically what we mean by vice here is, again, like I was talking about the mores always have taboos. The thou shalt nots part of the more system. And habitual violation of taboo is vice. Right. So You know, and we carry that forward, the vice squad, right? I mean, you're violating taboos, and religion picks that up, and, well, transgression of taboo, that's sin, says religion, says evolutionary religion. But, the point is here that the blue man, had definitive taboos about not debauching the maidens. There was no respect of that. There was habitual violation of that. Okay, so it's a vice. That's the point there. And separate that from, this is not, it's not having to do with objective morality. Morality is a totally separate issue. Right, this is just taboo. And whether or not you sort of secularly call it vice or religiously call it sin, it's just taboo. Okay, now it doesn't mean it's arbitrary. It doesn't mean, oh, well, so really? You can debauch the maidens and no one in the universe cares? No, I mean, it's just, it doesn't have to do with spirit, directly. Nonetheless, obviously there would be a lot of stability in this blue man culture that's going to be totally disrupted by these free-willing Adamites teaching blue man all sorts of unfortunate lessons and disrupting their culture. And again, like I said, the wholly free from the sexual vices. The degree to which there's sort of a superconscious predicate for Blue Man's thinking spiritually, right? They're using the perfectly. And then cosmically, they're using holy, right? So, in other words, Blue Man has a whole mori system that he's lifted up into the upper domain of the hourglass analogy, and there's a spiritual phase of that, and then the holistic phase, the cosmic phase of that, and they're very, very devout about that. Okay. All right, let's keep going.
These Cro-Magnon peoples were a brave and far-seeing race. They maintained an efficient system of child culture. Both parents participated in these labors, and the services of the older children were fully utilized. Each child was carefully trained in the care of the caves, in art, and in flint making. At an early age, the women were well-versed in the domestic arts and in crude agriculture, while the men were skilled hunters and courageous warriors.
Okay, so just you can just see the fullness of their use of their favoritism of the fourth adjutant. That energy of, in a crude way of the logic of ideas, the beginnings of the spirit of knowledge. You can just see how sad this, potentially is. I mean, that you would have the Adamites coming in and muddying the waters on what seems to be a very positive system. Okay. Especially you notice the child culture aspect there. You can't help but think about how when they mentioned how the Chinese had such a significant sense of family, child culture. Mm-hmm. So the blue man had that too, but it it got complicated. Okay, is there everything else there? I think. Yep. Let's keep going. Oh, you got some?
Well, just interesting that they would resort to polygamy if it threatened.
Oh, sure. I mean, they're very pragmatic about things, right? I mean, they're not self-destructive. It's like, well, okay, we've lost a lot of males, okay? I mean, we're going to have to double up here.
And they had a sense if they wanted a certain amount of population production.
Yeah, right.
Pretty insightful.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, and again, you know, like they just said, I mean, polygamy for Blue Man obviously was devoid of any sort of prurient, you know, thoughts or anything, right? I mean, it's just all very matter of fact.
The Adamites, they stem from Adam and Eve, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why were they into cheating?
Good point. See, notice how they threw in the mixed Adamites. Like I said, I mean, they're not going by horseback from the Second Garden, from Mesopotamia up into Europe. They're going very slowly. They're blending in. You know, they're kind of losing their focus, and their imagination is starting to run wild. And so, you know, that's why they're getting into that. And again, it's the double-edged sword. You get a little bit of spiritual energization, and you have all of these libertine ideas now in your head, but if you don't have some additional that can kind of get up on top of that and govern it well, guide it well, it's a problem. There's a reason why there's an adjutant greater than the sixth adjutant, than that very intense energization of the sixth adjutant, that energy of zeal, all right, the spirit of wisdom, seventh adjutant, you know, needs to be above that, and to superimpose a governor on such intense juicing of your mind, especially an imaginative mind that, you know, to go off on all sorts of exploratory tangents, you know, like relative to sex. Okay, so you know, that's the deal. The more potential someone has, the more there needs to be lots of guidance by parents and whatnot, a culture, so that potential doesn't actualize in a very rogue fashion. When you're simple genetically, and you're kind of just naturally docile and, you know, and unimaginative, and so, you know, never, you know, imagine, I wonder what it'd be like to run out in the street, right? I mean, that you know, it never occurs to you, but if you've got a child with a little bit of Andite blood, you've got to watch them like a hawk, because they're always, you know, imagining this, that, and the other thing, imagining what it'd be like to ride their bike off the roof of the house, or, you know, whatever it might be, right? So that's the deal.
Yeah. He must have had a lot of that blood.
Right, so
all over YouTube.
Yeah. Okay. All right, yeah, keep going here.
The Blue Men were hunters, fishers, and food gatherers. They were expert boat builders. They made stone axes, cut down trees, erected log huts partly below ground and roofed with hides. And there are peoples who still build similar huts in Siberia. The southern Cro-Magnons generally lived in caves and grottos.
Okay, so again, you see all of the fourth adjutant things there that they're emphasizing, all the tool making and whatnot. You know, reminding you that, right, I mean, naturally you start with gathering and hunting sort of modes, and, you know, eventually various factors will move you towards herding and farming, right? But obviously you're starting back. And there's lots of water in play, so they're going to be boat builders. Okay? And that's very natural for them. They're tool makers, and so they're going to do things with tools, like build boats with their tools and log huts. And then, you know, you see them bringing in similar huts in Siberia, you know, even in recent times. You go, well, wait a minute. I thought we were talking about how there were Andenites up in there. Yes, and at the very least, Blue Man is interfacing with them, and they're picking up culture from them. Yeah, what they're reminding you there. Not to mention genetically blending in some, too, of course. It's all, you know, just about everything that they told you there is just pointing out what they are naturally, right? You know, and including even that straight-laced stuff of just, you know, how they're going to delight in precision because of their favoring of that individuality adjunct. So, you know, it's an unpacking of all the consequences of basically just that favoritism of the fourth adjutant, what they are naturally, and the Adamites are going to inject the beginnings of unnaturalness, right, with them, for good or for ill. That's the whole point. As soon as you can be unnatural, then it's in your free will hands whether that's a positive unnaturalness or a negative unnaturalness. Right?
Second side of the sword.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Okay, so I think we got everything there. Oh, the very end. That's right. So the southern Cro-Magnons generally lived in caves and grottos. Okay, that's where you're getting that first. Oh yes, that's right. It's like the southern half of France with all those caves and the fancy cave paintings. Right, that's the Cro-Magnoid peoples that are behind all that cave painting, and you know, a lot of times instead of calling it a grotto, you know, which means a shallow cave, right? They'll call it a rock shelter. Like, so if you're looking online, you know, you'll maybe see Cro-Magnoid rock shelter. Right here, they're calling that rock shelter a grotto. Other times, it's a deeper thing. It's a full-on cave. Right. But that's there was lots of those naturally because of the kind of bedrock that you had around there. So, you know, why build something when you've got, you know, nature supplying something that's basically what you need to begin with. So they're just using what they found there naturally. All right, what else do we have here?
It was not uncommon during the rigors of winter for their sentinels standing on night guard at cave entrances to freeze to death. They had courage, but above all, they were artists. The Adamic mixture suddenly accelerated creative imagination. The height of Blue Man's art was about 15,000 years ago, before the days when the darker-skinned races came north from Africa through Spain.
I see. So obviously, if they're down there in kind of the southern parts of Europe, with this juiced up, you know, or maybe a better way to say it is there was a lot of artistic potential in Blue Man that got actualized by that little bit of Adamic blood. But if they're down there in the southern parts of Europe, especially the southwest there, as soon as people start coming up from northern Africa, you know, and feeding in, you know, into southern Europe there to, you know, to end up giving the brunette variation, you know, of the southern white race eventually there in southern Europe, you know, that's going to modify this. But until that becomes, you know, sort of reaches a level that sort of swamps this previous activation, right? They're very just endlessly fascinated with doing artwork in caves.
Yeah. So, you know, if these guys were so smart, why would they freeze to death out in front of the caves? Why don't they start a fire or come inside for a few minutes?
They answered that question in the next sentence. They had courage, right?
Courage, stupid.
No. Is it stupid to die to protect your family?
Well, or start a fire. I mean, somebody's going to come in and get you.
Fire.
To keep warm. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
No, it just, you know, I mean,
I get it.
You know, which peoples on the planet coined the phrase, ours is not the question why, ours is but to do and die? Right?
Valley of death.
Right? It goes all the way back. There's, you know, I mean, you just.
No, I understand. Yeah, see?
Again, it's just.
When it says lots of them,
I'm so Right? I mean, they're just, you look like you're pregnant with a thought or the gene, no? I mean, they're just, they're...
A bleeder valve.
It's just that if they were so smart,
Again, remember.
Why didn't they think of something a little better than?
Right. No. No. You see, again, don't think of them as quote unquote smart. These aren't, high intellects. These are pretty. Right. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that you know. I mean, they're still kind of just being in the moment, what they naturally tend to be. You know, it's like. I took this assignment, and I'm going to stick to it to the end, you know. And I'm not going to attract anyone with a fire. Like, oh, I wonder what's over there by that fire. Maybe we can go kill those people and take all their stuff. No, you got to keep the fires, you know. You can't be fires attracting people, right? So you stand guard in the dark. You're in Northern Europe, so you freeze to death, right? No, the next shift takes over.
They could have given a few more furs or blankets, or hats. I don't know.
It's probably like an honor, you know.
Yeah. See, I wasn't done yet. That was the point I was just about to get to. See, that's what it gets to. You willingly sacrifice yourself like that. It's a great honor to die at your post. You will be honored for generations, beyond you. Again,
yeah, wrote about you in this revolution.
Here we are.
I mean, remember, what's the whole point of the third adjutant? That's where you're willing, you can get apart from yourself enough that you can set yourself aside and sacrifice yourself. That's the whole point of the third adjutant. Right, that you recognize there's something greater here than the preservation of yourself in play. Because you're apart from that self, you can actually see that. When you're so into yourself, you can't see that there's something bigger than yourself. And it's, there's something worth dying for.
Think of them, and then in comparison, for instance, the yellow race or even the red race,
mm-hmm.
where they were at each other for 200,000 years.
Yeah.
But it was practically the entire yellow race was forced to have a cohesion there to mm-hmm. dominate. Where in Europe, you had a lot of individual variation among the tribes. So it was.
Yeah.
There wasn't a great threat that they all that forced them all together.
Right.
It was an individuated.
Right. See, again, we're back to the individuality consciousness of favoring the fourth adjutant. Right. You and you alone stand guard, The individuality of that. You know, and just the fact that there were many different groups, like you're saying, they didn't all pool into one great people. Again, because they're favoring that individuality. You know, it's our family against, you know, all odds. Right, we're going to build a log cabin in the middle of the great wild west, and we're going to stand against the forces of nature and whatnot. That desire to be this shining example of resilient individuality.
Yeah, a
stiff upper lip. See, that's it. Right, it's all that same thing. See, right, the stiff upper lip is you know just the forward variation of freezing to death while standing on night guard. It's the exact same consciousness. Right, quit complaining. Stand there, until you die. You know. You know, or like the story I always loved to tell when my dad was in the Navy during the Korean War, and they wore little simple radiation badges. And of course, you know what time it was. Everyone was very worried about nuclear attacks. Yeah, and it was a very simple little badge, you know, with just a few different levels of exposure indicated, and a little message next to each of the. You know, the little boxes, you know, if it's exposed, you know, three boxes up, you know, do this, you know. And the last, if it was a full exposure on this little you know, gauge, the description next to that final one said, death will occur in 45 minutes. Please resume your duties. All right, see, that's dying on night watch. It's the exact same thing. Right, and the honor of that, you know, that I went right back to my duties, knowing I was about to die. Right, there's something bigger than me in play. Right? That's that individuality, that rugged individualism, right, that comes from Blue Man. Yeah. And see, you animate that with even greater. Exaltation of its sacredness when you juice them up a little bit with some Adamic blood, right? That individuality becomes individualism, right? When you give them a little Adamic blood, and it's everything, right? That individuality, you know, there's nothing greater, right? You know, their name for God, right, is the Great Chief, right? The Supreme Chief. That supreme individual. What was that?
Earlier they talked about cleaning up the cave, you know, and you didn't clean up the cave, so you got night watch.
It's like a picture of you when you
died. Yeah, I mean, it to me it more or less shows the how really still pretty primitive they really are. I mean, it's hard to compare it, I think. To the consciousness we have today. It's kind of like when they talk about the apostles, you know, that they were learned men for their age, but, you know, not for this age.
Right.
I mean, so it's kind of, and it sort of helps me understand in a way, you know, that we're not dealing with people in this story that are people we can compare to directly.
Like, yeah, we're talking about people, you know, long time ago.
Experience that. So it's, yeah. You know,
this is way back in the Paleolithic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's also the same, like when there's been wars in this country are being involved. People always want to get involved in the war effort and sign up, and the women do what they can.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Just firing that. You know, the potential of the individual.
Yeah. We're blended way more than they were.
Yeah, sure. But we're also amped up a little bit more, too, right? And we haven't gotten to the story of how much Andite blood feeds into Europe. So anyway, you get the point. That's what's going on. And you have sort of this age, of Cro-Magnoid peoples there that reaches an apex and then starts to be modified for various reasons, as we saw there, like in the south with the Saharans coming in large numbers, and other things, as we'll read about as we go forward here.
It's amazing to me that the height of their art was 15,000.
Yeah.
Whoa, a blue man.
Uh-huh.
Good gosh.
Yep.
About 15,000 years ago, the alpine forests were spreading extensively. The European hunters were being driven to the river valleys and to the seashores by the same climatic coercion that had turned the world's happy hunting grounds into dry and barren deserts. As the rain wind shifted to the north, the great open grazing lands of Europe became covered by forests. These great and relatively sudden climatic modifications drove the races of Europe to change from open space hunters to herders, and in some measure to fishers and tillers of the soil.
Okay, so when the rain winds shift, you not only turn the wonderful part of northern Africa into the vast Sahara Desert, drive all those people out, but you take all this wonderful open land in Europe and turn it into dense, spooky forests that no one wants to live in. Okay. All those forests give us all of the stories that Europeans have about, spooky forests and whatnot, right? But just, picture that, back in the day, there was almost no trees all over Europe, and it turned into nothing but trees. So all these wonderful open space lands for hunting, you can imagine the huge herds of all these primitive animals that were way back, there thousands of years ago, all that goes away.
Yeah, I'm just struck by the fact that they adapted to the changing circumstances. If they didn't have the ability to adapt, many would have starved to death and they would just have a smaller population.
Mm-hmm.
But they were able to maintain the population by adapting to circumstances.
Yeah, and obviously this isn't just, I have a brilliant idea. Why don't we do this thing we'll call herding? Right. We all know, going all the way back 200,000 years ago, the prince and his staff, and then all of these Adamites, going in there. Right. They're bringing in, knowledge of what's beyond hunting, right? The concept of herding and the subsequent concept of farming, right? So they don't have a natural tendency to go there, but it's like, when push comes to shove, it's either adopt herding or starve to death. I guess I'll go to herding. And so that's what they did. But just to kind of, that it wasn't so much sort of a constant encouragement, say, by Adam and Eve, over millennia. Why don't you try farming? Why don't you try farming? The climate change drove them to it. Yeah.
How would they farm if the forest took over?
Well, they're in, the areas around the rivers and stuff where they got water to water the crops and stuff. And so you're just working in the river valleys, and just getting away from the dense forests. And you got a lot of big rivers, so that
they can do it.
And they have ag, right? So they can, they can cut trees.
Chopped down very many trees with a stone axe.
They didn't need big farms.
Yeah, right. You don't.
It's agriculture,
right? Yeah, they're not going out there with
before they get too big.
Giant GPS guided tractors or anything, So.
Freezing on watch.
Yeah. If anyone knows stories about the Vikings, they, how if they wanted to cut down lots of trees for whatever grand plan they had, you know. Right? So anyway, they were just driven to this by the change in the climate, and it just reminds you. See, again, you know, we had the default, okay, so that the second epical revelation dropped the ball, that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. Coincidentally, and you didn't have Adam and Eve sort of encouraging this directly, the changes in the climate and pushed them forward into that. See, it's all a vast conspiracy, right, for mankind to progress in spite of himself, to get up to the threshold of advancing civilization. One way or another, whether or not you follow the guidance of revelators or you're pushed by glaciers or, you know, or changing water, you know, laden winds or whatever the heck it is, right, you end up where you need to be, on the doorstep of being able to take a hold of your future, more of your own free will, and begin to progress because of yourself.
Was the climate part of some big plan?
Yeah.
Evolution?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge, you know, story in the revelation of how synchronized climate changes, geologic changes are to the evolution of man. Just to remind you, it's not two systems. There's only one system. Things and beings are all one system. It's all part of one evolutionary system. And it's all purposed to the same end. Worlds settled in light and life. Right? So there's a vast conspiracy in everything. Every rock is a part of a vast conspiracy. Every molecule of air is part of a vast conspiracy, right, that inexorably is moving towards the grand universe being settled in light and life. And the farther it gets along, the more the things and beings are sort of obviously one system. If you go to the central universe, things and beings are harmonized together in a way that we can't even imagine. Right? There's a total dance that the two are always in. You know, the cup doesn't just sit there, you know, seemingly having no relationship to my moving hands. Right? The things and the beings are all, you know, in an orchestrated system dancing together all the time.
Well, I was there last week, I didn't.
Yeah, when you... you mean when you got to the door and knocked and they said, "Do you have perfection of purpose?" And and you said, "No, not quite. Well, okay, come back in a few trillion years." Okay, anyway. So we just see it over and over again how important climate is when mankind is not able to really take a hold of themselves and still have to be sort of coerced forward. We're still in that mode, like I've said so many times. All of this is between the lines is, don't be surprised now that you have the scientific wherewithal to handle a lot of changes without it crushing civilization, that the climate of the planet will start changing again a lot. Used to change all the time, right? We gave you these few thousand years of a lull so you could kind of get your feet on the ground and get things sorted out. Okay, now you've been shoved out of the sheltered bays. Things are going to start changing again, right? And you're going to have to actually use your mind. You're going to have to use adaptability. That's the whole point of your mind. If nothing changed, what would you need a mind for? We could all just be fancy machines, right?
The climate in this room is changing.
If there was nothing to adapt to, right, mind wouldn't be needed. Okay, let's see. All right, so yeah, keep going here.
These changes, while resulting in cultural advances, produced certain biologic retrogressions. During the previous hunting era, the superior tribes had intermarried with the higher types of war captives and had unvaryingly destroyed those whom they deemed inferior. But as they commenced to establish settlements and engage in agriculture and commerce, they began to save many of the mediocre captives and slaves.
Captives as slaves.
And it was the progeny of these slaves that subsequently so greatly deteriorated the whole Cro-Magnon type. This retrogression of culture continued until it received a fresh impetus from the East when the final and en masse invasion of the Mesopotamians swept over Europe, quickly absorbing the Cro-Magnon type and culture and initiating the civilization of the white races.
Okay, so now, remember, we already dealt with the very, very degenerate stocks, you know, including stuff that was, you know, so backmated it wasn't even human anymore and stuff. All that's already been eliminated. But you always have a bell curve. And they had a kind of a basic, very ruthless eugenics program going here for a long time. But as soon as you need slave labor, right, like we've talked about so many times, that, you know, everywhere on the planet, you know, civilizations have suffered from using slaves and the sex urge being what it is, invariably, right, you start mating and you don't have as high a quality genetics as you once had. And so you still get a deterioration. It's just not, you know, it's basically kind of putting the peoples in Europe sort of into a suspended animation, sort of, you know, into a latent state, waiting to be activated again. The potential's still there. It's just that you short-circuited the spark that activates, that actualizes the potential. You didn't actually eliminate the potential by severely backmating. Okay. Like they say, the retrogression of culture, see, basically. So right at the end there, obviously they're done telling us the pre-Andite story. You know, now they want to get to that en masse invasion, like they're saying there. These huge waves of the Andites that are going to come in. Okay, and let's see, did we get everything else there? Notice that, you know, they're reminding you that it's not like they have some advanced genetic knowledge or something. They're just kind of going with how it seems to them, whom they deemed inferior, right? I'm sure there was some that they exterminated that, where it was unfortunate, you know, they didn't recognize the potentials that were there that, you know, they wiped out. But nonetheless, they had this desire to prevent going backwards, because there's, as we've just finished reading, you know, reminding ourselves of, there's this incredibly long, hundreds of thousands of years of this issue in Europe, unlike anywhere else on the planet. You know, over and over again, Europe had learned, oh, backmating, not good. And so it, it had been very enculturated, ingrained, and was obviously being passed on from generation to generation for hundreds of thousands of years. But the sex urge is very powerful. All right. Okay, so what about the Andites? Which is, you know, supposedly the Andite expansion in the Occident is what this paper's about. So now we're finally going to get to the Andites proper.
Number four, the Andite invasions of Europe. While the Andites poured into Europe in a steady stream, there were seven major invasions, the last arrivals coming on horseback in three great waves. Some entered Europe by way of the islands of the Aegean and up the Danube Valley, but the majority of the earlier and purer strains migrated to northwestern Europe by the northern route across the grazing lands of the Volga and the Don.
Okay, so remember we've talked about this before. You had these seven waves of Andites. And remember, we've talked about those final three, which were on horseback. You know, so they swept quickly from Mesopotamia to wherever they were going. And remember what the time range is for those final three waves, basically from about 8,000 BC to 6,000 BC. Yeah, so we're going all the way forward now from, you know, sort of immediately post Adam and Eve right up to the beginning of recorded history when we bring in those final three waves of the Andites, you know, that are going to sweep out all over from, you know, from the farthest west to the farthest east from Mesopotamia and set the stage of the planet from the Atlantic to the Pacific. As it is the beginnings of the annals of history.
Was there a land bridge that they could go across?
Where are we talking now?
From Mesopotamia to Europe, was there a land bridge?
Oh, no, that we're just going to... The main way, see, I mean, you know, they... Some of them are, you know, are playing around, you know, around Greece and Turkey there in the Aegean, like they just said, and following the Danube up into Central Europe, but most, as they've talked about this extensively before in previous papers, most of them are going immediately northeast from Mesopotamia around the eastern side of the Caspian Sea, and then up around to the north of the Caspian Sea. And see, when they say across the grazing lands of the Volga and the Don, in other words, across above the Caspian Sea and above the Black Sea, because right, Volga flows into the Caspian Sea and the Don flows, you know, eventually into the Black Sea. Right, so that, you know, they're just following that route up over the two great big lakes there, and heading into Europe that way. And especially when they're doing that on horseback, you know, it's not this slow walk where, you know, by the time you get anywhere, you don't even remotely resemble what it was that left Mesopotamia. I mean, they're going to do it in rapid fashion and bring significant Mesopotamian mentality around over into Europe. Okay, and we'll, you know, I've told you before, we'll get back to the story, you know, the bigger story about the Danube, you know, cutting up through Central Europe so significantly. A few sections forward here, the Danube plays a very major role in Europe ending up the way it is today, or at least the way it was, you know, sort of the beginnings of what we know of Europe. There's obviously so much blending now that then having a northern white race, a central white race, and a southern white race isn't as definitive as it once was. Right? But remember that whole bit of why is there a central white race? It centers around the Danube. Significance of it to migration, like they're talking about here. Okay. All right, I think I've got all that. Yep, keep going.
Between the third and fourth invasions, a horde of Andonites entered Europe from the north, having come from Siberia by way of the Russian rivers and the Baltic. They were immediately assimilated by the northern Andite tribes.
Okay, so you know, here you have again them mentioning you're going to blend a lot of Andonite in too. But you can see they're pointing out that big mass of Andonic stock was blended in prior to those final three significant waves of Andites. So you can blend in that much Andonite and you still have a lot of Andite that's going to be added in on top. You know, there's just so much Andite that went in the earth, but you can have all of this Andonite and Sangic stock, and there's still just heaps and heaps of of Andite blood to keep it upstepped, so it doesn't end up just all washing away, and you kind of just have a Sangic phenomenon. All right, let's see, anything else there? Just I'm mentioning horde of Andonites. Don't just think in, ooh, there was this big unruly mass or something. Remember, technically, before you have the concept of families, and then from that, clans, all right, you just have the horde. And in a very primitive people, there really isn't much of a concept of even families. It's just a horde mentality. So that's sort of the between the lines there. They're reminding you of, you have a limited cultural concept being poured in there in addition to the genetics. And of course, to go hand in hand, the limited genetics of Andonites is... why they aren't very progressive, see? And remember, the original pure Andonites couldn't even wrap their mind around the concept of grandchildren. That was too abstract for them. Children they could get. That's all kind of immediate. You do the thingy and a baby comes out. Right? I mean, they could wrap their mind around children, but grandchildren was just way too abstract a concept for them. So... obviously they're not going to be very progressive in going from horde to family to clan to tribe to nation to territorial state. Okay. All right, keep going.
The earlier expansions of the pure violet race were far more pacific than were those of their later semi-military and conquest-loving Andite descendants. The Adamites were pacific, the Nodites were belligerent. The union of these stocks, as later mingled with the Sangic races, produced the able, aggressive Andites who made actual military conquests.
Okay, see, so it... all that stuff, they're just reminding you, all that stuff we're talking about that led to Cro-Magnoid peoples with all those Adamites coming in there, none of that was military conquest sort of thing. It isn't until you have Andites that you really start having that kind of there's cultural changes or genetic changes because there was a preceding military conquest. And that innate warring nature of the Nodites, the belligerent nature of the Nodites, started that process. The initial Andites are basically just Adamites blended with Nodites, and immediately that's bringing in a warring sort of a mindset. And then, like I say, you throw in the Sangics, and Right. Yeah, you're off to the races, okay. Especially on horseback. Yep.
You know, when you have slaves, you have a two-tier culture.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something additional to that. You've got these new conquerors.
Yep.
So they take the top.
Yep.
The social, they're the top social class.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is down below them. You get this, start getting a vertical.
Yes.
Structure.
Yes.
In place.
Yeah, they're about to bring that up. That you're about to set up, that ruling class phenomenon in Europe, right? That, yeah, it's still basically there today. I mean, it isn't as definitive as it once was, because there's a lot of uprising of, that's happened in recent centuries in Europe to overthrow the total dominance of that northern white race ruling class phenomenon in Europe. But, right, you're about to, they're going to mention that. You're about to very definitively set that up with these Andite military conquerors, especially the final ones, like we were just saying. The cavalry men that that come in. Okay.
But the horse was the evolutionary factor which determined the dominance of the Andites in the Occident. The horse gave the dispersing Andites the hitherto non-existent advantage of mobility, enabling the last groups of Andite cavalrymen to progress quickly around the Caspian Sea to overrun all of Europe. All previous waves of Andites had moved so slowly that they tended to disintegrate at any great distance from Mesopotamia. But these later waves moved so rapidly that they reached Europe as coherent groups, still retaining some measure of higher culture.
So I already hinted at that before. So there it is. They're sweeping around the Caspian Sea now and going into Europe. And like I said before, I always have to challenge myself to not say cavalry, but to say cavalry, right? right. And just remember, cavalry just means horse, right? Cavalry men is horsemen.
Wait, you have to wait for Pam to be here to do this section.
Again, like they're pointing out, I mean, even more than what happened in other places to the east when the Andites are coming out of Mesopotamia, is, you don't have all of the, intense mountain pass barriers and all this sort of stuff like you do when you go to the east. I mean, they can just sweep, on horseback, up around the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and over into Europe. So, like they're pointing out, the horse was very, very important in relative to Europe. Okay. I guess we have everything there. We've kind of all talked about it in advance. So, let's keep going.
The whole inhabited world outside of China and the Euphrates region had made very limited cultural progress for 10,000 years when the hard-riding Andite horsemen made their appearance in the 6th and 7th millenniums before Christ. As they moved westward across the Russian plains, absorbing the best of the blue man and exterminating the worst, they became blended into one people. These were the ancestors of the so-called Nordic races, the forefathers of the Scandinavian, German, and Anglo-Saxon peoples.
So, as I was pointing out before, and notice, even a little bit more recent, than 8,000 to 6,000 BC. Obviously, you know, when you penetrate all, getting penetrated all the way around, it actually gets, you know, into the sixth millennium, right, from 6,000 to 5,000 BC. And you know, so, you know, like I occasionally point out, I mean, it's you can kind of say recorded history began in 6,000 BC, you know, in some locations, and you have kind of that transitional millennium of the sixth millennium BC, and definitely by 5,000 BC, you know, you have a people spread far and wide on the planet that, you know, are the beginnings of what we know today, right? You know, and you know, are the beginnings of the culture that we hearken consciously back to. Okay, and notice that whole bit of them starting to not be so discriminating about what they mated with. Right, that okay. It's being brought back. These Andites are, you know, are coming in fast and with a very definitive idea of, you know, we're not going to have anything to do with something that, you know, we deem inferior, and so wholesale extermination is back in play, and you're going to, you know, you're going to clean out, at least for a while, all of the lesser genetics, you know, in some areas of Europe. And of course, as we all know, this you know, this recycle repeats itself, and you start bringing in lesser genetics again.
But today we don't have that idea of inferior or superior at all.
We have the idea, but we're not allowed to talk about it. You know, I mean, we all know the politically incorrect thing of this. You know. Right, it's willful, you know, blinding. You know, we choose now to ignore the facts of genetics in you know, human mating.
So that's problematic, right?
Yeah, it's very problematic, as we all know. The book talks about it over and over and over again, because you know, see, so you hear, like I said, you hear way back then, you know, say by 5,000 BC, you've kind of cleaned house again. But, you know, time rolls forward and, you know, there's this wonderful Greek civilization, but then they start having more slaves in there and they start mating with it and Greek civilization evaporates. And then you have the Roman civilization that comes in and everything is going great, but then they start mating, and Roman civilization, you know, disappears. Right? I mean, it's the same story over and over again. Right, there's so little Andite blood on the planet, you know, that if you dilute it, you know, kind of anything beyond a tiny little bit, right, I mean, the people just lose their whole directional sense and there just can't be any sort of a significant civilization. Everyone just kind of falls back into place and kind of does the natural evolutionary stuff. You lose that unnaturalness of civilization, and it just becomes society and culture again. You know, that's, you know, we all know the book is trying to remind us nothing's changed. There's still very little Andite blood on the planet, and you've got one tiny little spear point, you know, of sort of self-actualizing civilization on the planet, and right, if that light goes dark, then what? Right? You know, government of the people, by the people, for the people, will perish from the earth. You know, and we see, you know, I brought that up purposely because, you know, just culturally, you can see what's happening in the United States. There's lots of forces that just don't get what this is. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. I mean, whatever. You know? you know, wouldn't it be better if we just had a group of self-appointed elites that just ruled us as benign dictators? Yeah. How long are they going to be these wonderful, imaginary, benign dictators? But it's just, it takes you have to have a lot of sense of individuality. And we're losing that, more and more. It's like, no, I think we just have some central authority that tells us what we can think and how we should think. And we should get rid of all the individuality. That's problematic. That's non-Andite natural thought creeping back in. Right? It's unnatural to stand unmoved, as Amadon did. Right? Right, to have that individual integrity, that has thoughts like, I think I have an individual right to free speech. Right, things like that. as you lose that that activated, directionized, personalized human mind, right, things pool back into very limited expressions. It's not like civilization will utterly vanish and there's no light and life possible, but there could be a very long interregnum for mankind to find his directional sense and enough individuality that an absolutely unique personality can identify with it and do something. Your absolute unique personality can't function in some uniform pool. You have to individuate out of some uniform pool. We are one people. All these, collective thoughts. Those can't be personal. Right? Personality is absolutely unique. It requires a definitive individual. You can see how important Blue Man is. See, in the mix on every planet. Right? Every planet has Blue Man. Because how could you ever get to some definitive personalization of that evolutionary stock if you didn't have a primary sangic stock that innately had a sense of individuality because of what adjutant they favor? An individual that a drop of water that separates itself from an ocean, so an absolute unique personality could identify with it. Blue Man is very important. And they're going through that, stressing that, to the eventual achievement of personalized selves in a definitive way on every world. You can't have it all washed out in some unity fuzz.
So unity is only real when it's like that.
Unity is the inspiration for individuality. It's not an alternative to individuality.
They go hand in hand.
Right?
Neither of them are real.
Right. Yeah. And obviously, individuality is the foundation. What's the point of unity if it has no foundation upon which to rest? And so, Blue Man, what we're reading here is very important. And then activating that enlightened individuality with some Adamic blood, right, to be the foundation for a great people that advance towards light and life as definitive personalized selves. Right?
When you think about the forefathers, they had a very strong individuality, and they had a lot of insight too. They were definitely cosmic thinking. Just they had that going on, but then it just, like, all these things come in, forces to
The fog up the clarity of it. Yeah,
now that people have no real some people have no true appreciation of what we are.
Right, what we're attempting to do here. Right, what this is about. Obviously, you're going to have a lot of cosmic consciousness. It's going to take a lot of wisdom, insight, and foresight. If you have very definitive individuals, every personality is absolutely unique, has an absolutely unique purposing that it's attempting to manifest. That doesn't just naturally all fall into parallel lines, okay, and everyone marches together, right? I mean, everyone is going in every which direction on an absolutely unique ray, from a center point. So it's going to take, a lot of cosmic consciousness to construct a system where all of those rugged, animated individuals can come together in some harmony.
Kindred mind, define the kindred mind.
Right? I mean, it's not immediately obvious how a tuba and a piccolo play the same piece of music together. Is it? Right? Think of the objectivity that's in play to go, I can think about a way where I can have a tuba and a piccolo and they're playing the same song. Okay, and everything in between. Right? That doesn't happen naturally. Yeah. Naturally, everyone picks up a bone and pounds on the same hollow log in unison.
Still not harmonious.
That's what happens naturally.
I'm just thinking.
Okay.
One other thing I wanted to say about that. Yep. We were just reading it. On that sentence. 10,000 years when the hard-riding Andine horsemen made their appearance in the 6th and 7th millenniums before Christ. They brought in Christ.
Yes.
On that.
Yeah.
It was really tying into something so much bigger.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, I should have emphasized that they made a point of saying before Christ, spelling it out to remind you how we're setting the stage for Christ and what happened from him to have happened. Right? You're setting the stage for that. Not just setting the stage for subsequent European civilization and whatnot, you're setting the stage for Christ and the apostles going out and finding a foothold in this place called Europe. And why? Was it by force or coincidentally the stage was sort of set there? Right? Yeah. Okay.
I have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they bring these Scandinavian, German, and Anglo-Saxon? What is that group?
Well, like I said, they're just pointing out that you're going to have three races. We're going to eventually get to that. You have the northern white race, the central white race, and the southern white race. And we basically know what constituted how the northern white race came to be. No. Right.
It was not long before the superior blue strains had been fully absorbed by the Andites throughout all northern Europe. Only in Lapland, and to a certain extent in Brittany, did the older Andinites retain even a semblance of identity.
So again, see the margins. Shove them out onto that little point of Brittany, out into the Atlantic Ocean there, or shove them again up to the northern margins. And even if, over time, you don't have as definitive a genetic differential because, there's ongoing blending. Nonetheless, you can especially with Lapland, right? The Laplanders, you know, have this very different kind of aboriginal sort of a culture way up there in the north. And you can see, you know, the fact that there's some blue man blended in there. You can see the mongoloid, like, you know, primary Sangic stock, like I pointed out. You know, my Norwegian heritage definitely will occasionally, you know, have that coming out, you know, where you get, a little bit of the eyes, like, you know, like, say, like the yellow man, things like that. You know, you get someone that looks practically Polynesian, say, you know, in our family, because there's so much primary Sangic kind of flaring up there. But you've got those Finno-Ugric languages, see, again, up there, like I was saying, those non-Indo-European, non-Andite, you know, i.e. Andonite, then, you know, languages up there across all of, you know, I mean, you know, not only just right immediately up there in Northern Europe, but with the Laplanders, but extending all the way across and kind of blending into the Siberians, people in the very northern part of Siberia, all the way over to the Pacific.
Laplanders have blue books.
That's all I can think of. It's fun to see them wearing blue hats. Do a little digging on, you know, on Laplanders. Guess we have everything there. Yeah. The stressing. You see, in Northern Europe, they're going to be fully absorbed by the Andites. So you're setting this up in Northern Europe where you don't have sort of the very Andite upstep peoples and maybe some that aren't quite so much, you know, accepting the Laplanders and stuff, okay? But you basically have just this very well-blended, what's going to become the ruling class. Right, this very dominant, directionized people. The rest of Europe, you know, it's not going, you know, there's going to be a lot of blue man still to the south. It's going to take a while to deal with. But you set it up in the north, you basically don't have blue man anymore. Cro-Magnoid blue man in the north now. It's now the northern white race. Okay, so what about the more details here of Northern Europe?
Number 5, the Andite conquest of Northern Europe. The tribes of Northern Europe were being continuously reinforced and upstepped by the steady stream of migrants from Mesopotamia through the Turkestan South Russian regions. And when the last waves of Andite cavalry swept over Europe, there were already more men with Andite inheritance in that region than were to be found in all the rest of the world.
Yeah, like they've pointed out many times, there's such a, you know, most of the percentage of all the Andites, you know, went there, as we've read many times. Okay.
For 3,000 years, the military headquarters of Northern Andites was in Denmark. From this central point, there went forth the successive waves of conquest, which grew decreasingly Andite and increasingly white, as the passing centuries witnessed the final blending of the Mesopotamian conquerors with the conquered peoples.
So again, just stressing, like I was saying, how, you know, when all is said and done up there to begin with, you don't have, you know, a ruling class and lesser peoples. It's all just the northern white race now up there. And like we were talking about, remember, when the ice left, you have all that land to the north that's rising, and you took the ice pressure off of it, and Jutland, you know, rose up out of the sea because of that, and Denmark. And that became the nucleus of the northern white race, and that literally continues down till today. You know, if you think about the mentality of the Norwegians, the Swedes, and the Danes in the face of, would someone like to help us with a war? The Norwegians say, I think we're too place-like. And the Swedes say, nah, I think we're too place-like. And the Danes say, yeah, I'm very direction-like. I'll join in your war. Right, you can get the Danes to join you. So most of the directional blood, left Northern Europe and came to the United States, right, and left relatively place-like peoples in Scandinavia. But there, there's place-like and then there's place-like. See, and today, what differential there is, in terms of more directional peoples is still more in the ancient headquarters of the Northern White Race in Denmark. They're the most directional. So you can see how Denmark kind of turned into a transplanted Mesopotamia. And they're pointing out it becomes this nucleus for Andite, and then white, spreading out from there. I mean, the last Andite migrations, if you will, now become, Northern White Race was, was them, going over to North America, them going east and establishing Russia, the Rus, those final Viking migrations are the tale of coming out from Denmark like they're talking about and founding all of the basic civilization that we know in Western civilization.
Were the Vikings from Denmark?
Yeah, I mean, see, they they have that core location there in Denmark, and they spread into to Sweden and Norway, obviously, but it always meant that remained the nucleus there.
What does place like
mean? The contrast between place and direction, if you favor the first three adjutants, any of the first six adjutants, those are more place-like. You don't want to necessarily head towards the horizon and do something. You want to do something a certain way right here. You're more of a homebody, okay? But you bring in the Adamic stock, that favors the seventh adjutant. That favors that directional adjutant in contrast to the first six. See, and it takes these potentials and actualizes them in the Sangic peoples and directionizes it towards somewhere. Okay, let's now that we've been animated, let's go towards that end. It starts getting you thinking about wanting to go to towards some end. I mean, think about how place-like, even people in Europe have always tended to be, in contrast to the northern peoples. The Vikings were always wanting to go everywhere, right? But a lot of people to the south, it's like, well, I'm born in this little village. I've never left this little village. The only thing I really know about is there's this little hill next to the village, and I know there's a village on the other side of that hill. I hate those people. It's just very place-like. But you give it a little bit of more Andite blood, and no one wants to just sit in the village they were born in. They dream of, being Alexander the Great and conquering the known world or something, right? Going, they're directionized and they're going somewhere. You're a Viking. I wonder what would happen if I sailed to the west. Oh, I discovered Iceland. And I discovered Greenland. And right, or I wonder what happened if I started sailing south. Oh, I discovered the Mediterranean. Why don't I take over, southern Italy? And you have that directional sort of mentality. Okay.
So are the records of that increasingly white? Any kind of records?
No, I mean, obviously, We know how difficult it was for a lot of records to stand, you know, from those northern peoples. I mean, what records we have are kind of recorded way down the road from oral tradition. You know, they're myths and things. Okay, let's keep going here.
While the blue man had been absorbed in the north and eventually succumbed to the white cavalry raiders who penetrated the south, the advancing tribes of the mixed white races met with stubborn and protracted resistance from the Cro-Magnons. But superior intelligence and ever-augmenting biologic reserves enabled them to wipe the older race out of existence.
Right, so they get it, you know, like I was just saying, they get it, this homogenized, you know, foundation set up in Northern Europe, and then they just start working south. Okay. And eventually, you know, conquer the whole region, basically, except for the, you know, areas that they didn't have a lot of interest in. You know, there's some backwaters areas when they're done, but mostly they, you know, they move south and take things over. Okay, keep going.
The decisive struggles between the white man and the blue man were fought out in the Valley of the Somme. Here, the flower of the blue race bitterly contested the southward moving Andites. And for over 500 years, these Cro-Magnoids successfully defended their territories before succumbing to the superior military strategy of the white invaders. Thor, the victorious commander of the armies of the North in the final battle of the Somme, became the hero of the northern white tribes and later on was revered as a god by some of them.
So that's where Thor comes from. And look at where it is again. It's in the Valley of the Somme. You know, when you think about this great battle of the Somme, as they're saying, wait a minute, wasn't there another battle of the Somme that I've heard of? All right, I mean, the great battle of World War I is the Battle of the Somme. I mean, that location has always been part of military struggles. And over a million people died there in the Somme Valley in the First World War in the Battle of the Somme. But that wasn't the first Battle of the Somme. Probably won't be the last Battle of the Somme. And, Thor became exalted in the, way back in the Somme Valley as the blue man finally was conquered militarily. I mean, there's still a lot, obviously farther to the south, lots of blue men. But all of their military energy is gone now, and now it's just people that are going to slowly be assimilated. All right.
Resistance is futile.
Yes. All right. When the gods come down from Asgard, you just have to give up finally. Yeah.
I don't know where it's going. Maybe it's not the right place. I don't know if I'm wording it right, but how do you get white skin? Because they're talking about white.
Oh, yeah. Remember, the whole deal there is you basically have a brown primary sangic sort of an individual. Remember, there's a red man and yellow man blended in. But even if there's a lot of predominance to blue, you're just piling in so much fair-skinned peoples from Mesopotamia. Right, these Adamite and then Andite peoples, that you just dilute all the color until it's just all washed down to quote-unquote white. Right? And then you have to look really closely or tan very carefully because you burn, you know, when you're lily white. But if you can look really closely, it's like, oh, yeah, like we talked about, I do have a bit of a red, you know, pigment to my skin, don't I? Or I do have a bit of a yellow pigment to my skin. I'm not as white as I initially thought. Right? I mean, there is some colored stock there. It's very washed down. Yeah, you just dilute it and dilute it and dilute it until, right, it just is white.
Yeah, we're we're lucky we're not all transparent.
Does it have something to do with like in the northern climates that the sun is less intense than in the southern also?
Right. Well, there's all these notions. It doesn't have anything to do with your latitude. It's just skin color. That they were just as lily white in Mesopotamia as they were in Denmark. Adam and Eve were very, very fair skinned.
And in Infanta were pre-color also.
Yeah, well, and in Infanta, see, they're, you know, they start out, you know, kind of, you know, with just, you know, the melanin, you know, so it's just that, you know, ruddy sort of complexion. Like I said, I mean, you end up with something that, if it wasn't diluted, would be some sort of shade of brownish, and then you just wash it all down until it's such a light brown it's white.
Yeah. No longer andites.
Yeah, I mean, and again, remember, andite is just, you know, when you're 1/8 to 1/6, you know, adamic, so. Right, but it's that Adamic and an andite stock that is, you know, so white, you know, skin color, you know, and then but when you finally dilute it, now you actually call that very diluted andite progenitor sort of phenomenon by their skin color. You call them the white race. You know, you could have called the Adamites the white race too. Okay, if you were just calling them by their skin color.
What race were the Hebrews?
Well, that's complicated. there's a lot of things. We'll get a little bit of that here next time. But anyway, that's the deal. It's just, you know, when you finally dilute it down, you know, you boil things down and you just call them by their skin color. All right. A lot of the blue men would have been pretty light-skinned, too. You got to remember, you know, we're not back in some original pure blue race here. I mean, these blue men have got a whole bunch of Andonite and an Adamite blended in. This is kind of quote-unquote blue man at this point. All right, the pure blue man, you know, started to disappear 300,000 years ago, right, when he started blending in with the Neanderthals. So, right, yeah, just, you know, but they have a lot more blue than these Andites coming in, right? So, you know, we're just calling them blue man in contrast. All right, keep going.
The strongholds of the blue man, which persisted longest, were in southern France, but the last great military resistance was overcome along the Somme. The later conquest progressed by commercial penetration, population pressure along the rivers, and by continued intermarriage with the superiors, coupled with the ruthless extermination of the inferiors.
Okay, so the northern white race keeps this up, even when they're not doing military conquest anymore, and it's just commerce and the natural sex urge phenomenon drifting southward. Right, they're still ruthless on exterminating inferiors. Yeah, so you can't help, it's like, huh, that whole ruthless extermination thing can flare up again, can't it, like it did in the 20th century. They're kind of reminding you that, no matter how twisted someone's notions might be, it's predicated on a very ancient recognition. Right, that goes all the way back to... you know, the Badanan tribe, you know, of if you're going to have any sort of a progressing civilization, you can't be blending in with inferior genetics. It pulls you down, and no one will even imagine civilization anymore, let alone achieve it. You know, it's hard for us to keep that in mind. It's like, oh, well, I would always be imaginative. No, you wouldn't. If you were genetically drugged down enough, your imagination would disappear. You would have no imagination anymore. That all is dependent upon Adamic blood lifting you up to an imaginative level.
Imagination
Imagine that. Imagine that.
How do you recognize inferior genetics? Would it have to be scientific?
Well, yeah, right, that's obviously the problem. You know? But even the fact that we don't understand the physics of inferior superior in any great detail doesn't change the fact that it's there. Humans have always basically known as there. They've crudely tried to, you know, figure out a science of it and act upon it.
Can you measure it?
Yeah, I mean, eventually, yeah. I mean, the life carriers can measure all this stuff to 90 decimal places, of course, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, eventually we'll be taught all this stuff. But we need the prince and his, you know, Machaventa Melchizedek to assume planetary prince and genetic teacher, you know, quote unquote material son, genetic teacher. And, we need to learn all this stuff. We need to learn how to properly blend the races eugenically, well genetics. And then we have to learn genetic engineering to be able to improve it beyond what you can do just by, you know, proper genetic management. Yep.
Maybe it wouldn't be so politically incorrect if people could see it's part of the grand plan of deity to have inferior, superior, and deal with that. Mm-hmm. And it stimulates people to become better. And it's not like the inferior people are lost. They get to go to the mansion worlds. Also.
Yeah, and again, remember, when there's all this ruthless extermination of stuff, you know, basically, no one is thinking, how about we're all children of God? You know, no one's thinking like that. I mean, no one is confused about blurring spiritual and material. And I mean, they're all very matter of fact about it. They just judge everyone materially, you know. It's like, you know, back in these times, see, you know. It's difficult now because, you know, we also know that they're not just a blob of protoplasm, right? That they have a spiritual nature that God loves absolutely, and we get very, you know, it's very difficult for us to think pragmatically about these issues anymore.
But we can trust the over control.
Right. But we'll all have to just trust, yeah, the over control. All right, let's keep going here.
When the tribal council of the Andite elders had adjudged an inferior captive to be unfit, he was, by elaborate ceremony, committed to the shaman priests, who escorted him to the river and administered the rites of initiation to the happy hunting grounds, lethal submergence. In this way, the white invaders of Europe exterminated all peoples encountered who were not quickly absorbed into their own ranks, and thus did the blue man come to an end, and quickly.
Yes, I shall be merciful and quick. again, you know, here's the two happy hunting grounds. See, once without quotes and once with quotes. Okay, the second one in quotes. That's in Ghostland, right? You know, where you dream about the happy hunting grounds without the quotes, right? You know, and you believe that dreamland is you know, a reality that you call Ghostland or Spiritland, and you're it's an elaborate ceremony and everything. See, there's measure of of a spiritual sort of acknowledgement here. You're treating them very well. But you're eliminating them from the gene pool, right? So that's, you know, yeah, it's their method of, just kill them all and let God sort it out. All right, keep going.
The Cro-Magnoid blue man constituted the biologic foundation for the modern European races. But they have survived only as absorbed by the later and virile conquerors of their homelands. The blue strain contributed many sturdy traits and much physical vigor to the white races of Europe. But the humor and imagination of the blended European peoples were derived from the Andites. This Andite blue union, resulting in the northern white races, produced an immediate lapse of Andite civilization, a retardation of a transient nature. Eventually, the latent superiority of these northern barbarians manifested itself and culminated in present-day European civilization.
Okay, so well, that's pretty straightforward. We've talked about a lot of it already, but just to stress again, see, there, you don't have any sort of lingering skin color manifestation of how much blue man is in, you know, is in the European stocks. But definitely the adjutant favoritism of blue man for the fourth adjutant is there. Skin color, no. Mind favoritism, yes. Right? Where did the Industrial Revolution, right, begin? Not in a people that favor the fifth adjutant or the sixth adjutant. No, the people that favor the fourth adjutant, the spirit of knowledge. It's just inescapable. Yep.
Do we have any idea how much Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal is mixed in, like, all the way up to us?
Well, this bit of all this, the fact that the revelators lay out some of these details, now scientists that are doing all these genetic studies, you know, predicated on their false assumptions, which can't really be anything but false because it's so difficult to sort it out without aid from a revelation like this. I mean, yeah, now they could really engage those genetic studies with a little bit more understanding and figure out, oh, this is that, and this is that, and I mean, they're making guesses now, and we'll be able to sort all this out, especially with some help, you know.
I remember you making a comment in the past that we have hair because of Neanderthals.
Well, it's the sort of non, you know, kind of normal sanguic hair, you know, that Europeans have, you know, that comes from the back mating, you know, with the subhuman stocks way, way, way back in hundreds of thousands of years ago. You know, back mating producing back hair, for instance, right? I mean, literally. You know, a more pure sanguic person doesn't have much in the way of facial hair even, you know, let alone a lot of body hair.
Yeah. And the older we get, the more pure sanguine we become.
The more sanguine we are, the body. And it just starts growing everywhere, yes. Yes, thank you, back mating ancestors. I'm really delighted that you gave me a beard that now is not shaveable. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, like I said, we've got the 5000 BC thing here, so that's how they end here.
By 5000 BC, the evolving white races were dominant throughout all of Northern Europe, including Northern Germany, Northern France, and the British Isles. Central Europe was for some time controlled by the Blue Man and the round-headed Andonites. The latter were mainly situated in the Danube Valley and were never entirely displaced by the Andites.
So there, see, you have a little bit of a hint. You know, like I said, what is it, section 8, I think it is, isn't it? Yeah, section 8 is when we get to that directly. You have a whole bunch of Andonites penetrating up into Central Europe, you know, with their round-headedness relative to the long-headedness and giving that differential of the central white race. You know, and you notice things like Northern Germany, right? So that you have the long-heads, the Plattdeutsch in Northern Germany, and the round-heads and the Hochdeutsch in Southern Germany. Yeah, all those differentials are being set up. And not to mention, it's obvious that you've got, like I said many times, you have the seeds for an aristocracy phenomenon, right, that maybe is not governmentally active in a lot of places in Europe today, but it's still present. it sort of got reconstituted with the Normans and spread out all over Europe as the ruling class, you know, 1,000 years ago. So, you know, all that's being set up. And so, like I said, by the time you get to kind of those final kind of big shifts in the 6th millennium BC, by 5,000 BC, things were, you know, the stage was kind of set over the world. And the climate was settled down. You set the stage, you calm down the climate. And for 7,000 years now, the climate's been relatively stable, and all of this latent civilization could get going without being disrupted by severe climate changes in the climate. And now we go forward from here.
And the nights were sure persistent.
Yeah. You know, the Charlie Browns of the world are the round-headed ones. Yep. They're willing to kind of go to the margins where they're kind of left alone, and they just they go on and on and on and on. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.